Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Villander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah.
Hi, this is Ashley from Washington, D.C., and you are listening to the award-winning Tennis Podcast.
Well, hello and welcome to the Tennis Podcast. And thank you to Ashley there in Washington, D.C. for brilliantly introducing the show and for pointing out that we are indeed an award-winning tennis podcast. David, we do like it when other people point it out because we like it to be known, but we don't want to be the arseholes pointing it out. So, Ashley, that is an ideal scenario for us to start the show. Hello, David.
Yeah, hello. I couldn't have put it any better myself, Catherine. So thank you very much, Ashley. Yes, that remains the highlight of 2023, or one of them. And yeah, bring it up anytime you like.
Absolutely. Matt, hello. How are you doing?
Hello. Very well, thank you. Yes, we should probably like just encourage people to do it and then we'll get it every week. Be great.
I mean, I have done just that, Matt. So
I think all three of us.
I would expect to be inundated with mentions of our award-winning status. David, you're still you still have custody of the trophy. Is it in safe hands?
Yeah, it's in the living room. I was looking at it just this morning whilst getting ready to watch the Super Bowl. You know, I thought, you know, there's the Lombardi trophy that they're playing for. But, you know, we've already got ours. It's just on the windowsill.
They do that thing that the Australian Open does and certain other tennis tournaments. But I most associate it with the Australian Open at the Super Bowl, where they have the trophy sort of on display on the field of play, dangling there as a carrot in front of the competitors, which... at the Australian Open, I find what a head spin that must be.
Although that was low key a bad thing about the Australian Open this year, I think, in that they covered the trophies up during the final with their Louis Vuitton box.
Yes, yeah, so
that
they got a luggage sponsor.
Got it sponsored in.
So there was a box involved, but it was there on display some of the time. Was it just during the warm ups and then they put it away?
And they covered it up.
Right.
Nothing sacred, is it?
Matt was really unhappy about the baggage. I said, I think it's a sponsor opportunity. I don't care.
Why would you cover up, Daphne?
Anyway, yes, we are in a strange alternate universe where I'm the one that stayed up to watch the Super Bowl and Matt and David didn't. What is life? What is going on? It was great.
Imagine if somebody said that to you, like, Three years ago when you were complaining about men bending over all the time.
Yeah, I was questioning much. There was quite a lot of just, I mean, the Super Bowl is the most faffy of all the NFL events, isn't it? It's
I mean, 6 hours. So that's how much recorded on my box this morning when I woke up. But I was reminiscing about how my childhood was full of a set piece event once a year that was even more full of faff than the Super Bowl, and that was the FA Cup final. Now, you two are probably too young to remember how it used to be when it was simulcast on both ITV and BBC One, the two terrestrial channels. And it was the day in the football calendar of the year. And it began at 7 in the morning. The coverage started at 7 in the morning at the hotels of the players of the two teams. And then they had a camera on the bus to sort of film the two teams as they came wending their way down the roads towards Wembley Stadium, and they had a meet the manager section. This was the only coverage you got all year that wasn't live stuff. And in fact, it was pretty much the only live game for a while that you got as a kid, because of various sort of channel strikes and European bans and all the rest of these things. I mean, it was incredible as a day, as a set piece day. But my word, you are talking about 8 to 9 hours of build up.
Were there two different versions of a national anthem? America the Beautiful and the Star Spangled Banner.
That's true. Yeah, we came up short there. I have to say,
good tunes, both of them. But I really got the idea after America the Beautiful. And
yeah, and they only cried in the one last night. They didn't cry in the FA Cup final one, as I recall. Mind you, Abide With Me, I suppose, was almost like a national anthem. People cried in that, absolutely.
Delving into the depths of David Law's brain, we don't have time for this. There's so much tennis that's happened this week. I came into this thing, I've got to be disciplined today, because tennis being tennis, it's been happening here, there and everywhere this week. We've got to truck on, folks. And I think we should start in Abu Dhabi, the biggest event in terms of points and in terms of lineups, I think, over the course of the last week. The WTA 500 there, won by Elena Rybakina. She beat Daria Kazatkina 6-1, 6-4 in the final. Kazatkina having come through the most extraordinary semi-final match against Beatriz Adajmayr in the previous round, and perhaps that did leave her a little gassed for the final, although I'm not sure even on full gas she would have much answer for Elena Rybakina in this kind of form, because this, Matt, was Elena Rybakina as we saw in Brisbane. And I know this already lives rent-free in your head, but this past week makes what happened in Melbourne to Elena Rybakina even more inexplicable.
Mm. It does, really. And I sort of blame Adelaide. And I'm sorry to anyone listening in Adelaide, but I really don't think Elena Rybakina needed to play Adelaide before the Australian Open. That, I think, is where things went a bit wrong for her. Like, she had the perfect preparation in Brisbane, then had that weird week in Adelaide when she got involved in a match that I think was a little, you know, it was long. I think, you know, she felt like it was taking it out of her. And you've always got the Australian Open in the back of your mind. And then she didn't have her best game in two matches in Melbourne and ended up losing, as we know, in that extraordinary tiebreak to Blinkova. And yet here in Abu Dhabi, she didn't actually sort of start the week all that well. She was pretty ropey in her first match against Danielle Collins. I mean, a very, very tough first match. Obviously, Collins having beaten Naomi Osaka and looked to be in really good form. And she was beating Rybakina pretty handily. And it took a pretty remarkable turnaround from Rybakina. But then after that point, she really did find her game. And a win over Samsonova in the semi-final was big. That was one of those weird head-to-heads. You know, she was 0-4 against Samsonova, had never beaten her, but finally managed to get that win. And then in the final, honestly, that head-to-head to me was really surprising that was 2-2, because that to me just looks like a total nightmare for Kazatkina, you know, in terms of the fact that Rybakina's got such a big serve and she can dominate Kasatkina's relatively poor serve on return, and just the huge power discrepancy between the two players. You just feel like Rybakina should be winning that match kind of every single time, as long as she's on her game. And I feel like Kazatkina tried to overplay a little bit. She tried to meet some of Rybakina's power, and that just wasn't the play, because I mean I kind of don't think anyone can, other than maybe Sabalenka. So yeah, like a really, really good week for Rybakina. She had to come through a very awkwardly timed rain delay as she was serving out the match. It sort of felt like everyone else would really freak them out, but she was like really calm and just sat down and just waited for it to subside so she could hit her big serves and close it out. But it does, as you say, it makes the Australian Open and it makes Adelaide even more curious. You know, it's been a really good start to the season. She's won two titles. She's looked incredibly dominant on those title runs. And yet, I don't know, would you trade that for a better Australian Open? Like, you might. I suppose winning the Australian Open, you certainly would trade it. But it just kind of makes it tough to sort of figure out where Rybakina is, because like her top level is absolutely awesome, we know that, but she's not bringing it at the slams in the last year since last year's Australian Open. So yeah, just a sort of fascinating case right now, Rybakina.
Yeah, I watched that Rybakina Collins match, and I thought it perfectly summed up the benefits of either qualifying, which actually Collins has done this week in Doha. She's gone straight into qualifying and actually got through the draw there. And in this instance, playing a first round versus a player who's got a bye. And you saw Rybakina in this race against time to try to find her form to stay in the match long enough in order to take over. And it really looked like she was going to run out of time because Collins was bringing it. I mean, it was a pretty comfortable first set, and then she's just so aggressive in the second set. You're hearing her every ball around the sort of two all and three all mark, and Rybakina is just having to sort of dig her feet into the ground and try and withstand this force coming her way and stay with it. And eventually, I then left the match for a while and came back to find she'd just taken it over and won. And thereafter, she just felt like, well, she's the class player in this field. And in the final, and it just wasn't a match because Kasatkina, I share that view, too, all that surprises me. And I think, I guess it comes down to, is Rybakina on or is she not? Mm. Because Kasatkina can play lovely tennis, but she's not going to have an answer to that sort of brute power and ball striking if it's really hitting its mark. Just generally, I thought it was a really interesting week of tennis, and I'm pleased to see Rybakina rebound from that Australian Open, which I think that Adelaide match can't be a complete accident, that is not irrelevant to what ended up happening, because I remember watching her in all the matches she played at the Australian Open, she just never looked quite settled and right, and it was kind of like the microcosm of the Collins match, and yet she never overcame the issue she was having early on to get settled. And I think there's probably some lessons in there for her. I still look at her and think she's just about the complete player, really, when she's on, and I hope she can build on it.
Yeah. Agreed, absolutely agreed. She's one of my absolute favourite players to watch. Just the way she produces her power is one of my favourite things in the sport. Just wanted to touch quickly upon Danielle Collins that you mentioned there, just because she just keeps catching my eye. She's not winning these events. Yeah, she ended up losing to Iga Świątek at the Australian Open, and she ended up losing to Rybakina in Abu Dhabi. She's gone straight on, as you say, David, to Doha. She's qualified. I just feel like a liberated Danielle Collins, which is what we're seeing now, having made that decision that I presume took some time for her to come to, that this is going to be her last year on tour. I feel like she's got something quite big in her this year. I don't know exactly what that'll look like, and I know that's a real David Law-esque prediction.
They always work, Catherine.
She's exactly. Why haven't I been doing this all along? It feels to me.
Federer
like
definitely did take our breath away one more
he
time.
He did, exactly.
Told you.
He was never not going to, though, was he? That was always going to come off. David knows what he's doing. I think it's most likely to come on hard courts. I'm not saying she's going to win a Grand Slam, but I think she's going to do something quite big somewhere. And she can play on clay, can't she? So I've just really enjoyed watching Danielle Collins so far in 2024, and it hasn't amounted to anything seismic yet, but I just, you know, she's going to keep pushing, isn't she? I feel like she hasn't been able to do that for a while, and her rankings really dropped, but just clearly liberated by having finally made that decision that, that this is going to be her last year. I don't know. I think it could lead to good things. We should probably talk about Kazatkina a little bit. She's always got stuff to say, hasn't she? She's such a refreshing, often standalone voice on the WTA Tour in terms of standing up for stuff in an incredibly considered, intelligent way, I think. And the issue she's spoken up on this week is scheduling, sort of the lack of coordination between events and having reached the finals in Abu Dhabi, still being scheduled to play the very next day in Doha. She played a 5 p.m. final Abu Dhabi on Sunday, and then she was scheduled to play her first round match in Doha on Monday, she said. And these quotes are via Reem Abalil of The National, who's out there covering these Middle East events. She said, "It's terrible. I have a question. I don't know to who, WTA or to tournaments. Are you guys trying to make players die or to get injured often?" Kazatkina, this also is via Reem, she said, "Kazatkina acknowledges that nothing can be done given Doha has to start on Sunday so it can fill its Saturday finish, but hopes the situation can be addressed moving forward, be it with a performance bye or anything else." I mean, yeah, it just, I don't know, it seems counterintuitive to me. She's absolutely got a point, hasn't she?
Yeah, and I was going to say this does feel like the perfect time for those performance buys, which I know were a big issue last year, partly because Elena Rybakina sort of trashed them on Instagram with her, what was it, circus emoji, when she didn't get a buy, even though she was one of the top seeds, and those buys went to the players who had done well the previous week. But I do think there is something in that as an idea, especially when you've got one event starting on the same day that the other event is finishing, and there's the only way that Kazatkina can play her first round is to play it today. Otherwise, she would have to miss the tournament. I mean, Pliskova as well has come all the way over from Europe and is having to play first round today in Doha as well. So it really is a problem, and like so many of tennis's issues, it comes back to the calendar and it being too cluttered and there sort of being too much tennis. And these big events, these big WTA 1000 events squeezed into the month of February, it just doesn't quite sit right, I suppose, right now.
I know a lot of people will say, and I saw a lot in the comments and replies, which obviously one should never read. But anyway, there I was falling down the rabbit hole. Oh, well, you know, you don't have to play the event then. Nobody's making you play all these events. Well, OK, sure. But doesn't the WTA and the tournaments themselves want to make it possible for players to play as many of their events whilst giving themselves the best chance of staying fit and healthy? Like, everyone's interests are aligned here. So it just seems completely shooting oneself in the foot to not make that as possible as it can be. She's playing some lovely tennis, isn't she, Kazatkina? I mean, what an asset she is to the tour when she's playing like this.
Well, yeah, because she's so different, and actually, I think the point is you want them to be able to play as many events as possible and win them. You know, you don't want to be penalised for getting to the final, for goodness sake. that's a problem. But just generally, ever since she came on the scene, you know, you're talking, what, five, six years ago now, she's been one of my favourite players to just watch, just as a sort of guilty pleasure of watching a tennis player in rallies. I mean, you know, we're going to talk a little bit later about clay court tennis, because there were clay court events. And watching her on any surface reminds me of the things I love about watching every player on clay, because there's time to sit and enjoy just the stroke construction and the rally kind of constructing, and yeah, she's a joy to watch.
Yeah, and I think she, watching her matches this week, as you said, that brilliant one against Halej Meyer, like, I do think she's trying to work on that serve. Like, it really didn't come off in the final. It was a bit of a disaster, 9 double faults, and it just really cost her. But I do see like some effort to try and beef that serve up a little bit or just place it a little bit better, just because that really does hold her back. Because as David said, in the rallies, you know, the way she can construct points and manipulate the ball, she is just a joy to watch. And she's got a little bit of a problem in finals at the moment. She's obviously lost a couple this year, Adelaide and now Abu Dhabi. I think she's lost her last three. But she said that, you know, she's used frustration before to have good results. She talks about her French Open semi-final run coming off the back of a disappointing loss and that sort of motivating her even more. And look, this wasn't a disappointing loss, I don't think, because it was a great week overall and it's been a great season overall. But, you know, just trying to turn some of these brilliant runs into actual trophies and titles feels like the next step for her. But yeah, she's a sort of shining light really on in sort of all the ways.
Yeah, and I feel like the last player from Abu Dhabi that we should probably touch upon is Ons Jabeur. Scored a really impressive win, I thought, over Emma Raducanu, who played incredibly well, as well as I personally have seen her play for some time, but then ended up losing out to Beatrice Adajmayr in quite a distressing match. I mean, she was clearly very, very visibly upset through certainly the latter portion of that match, Jabeur. Now, this is a swing. These events are very, very important ones, Jabeur. I know there is now an event in Tunisia, but besides and that event being in Tunisia is a direct result of Ons Jabeur's success. But besides that, these are, you know, as close to home events as Jabeur will get. She gets a tremendous amount of support from obviously the Arabic community there, but expats as well. You know, these are a big deal for her. And I think there was a lot of speculation before the post-match quotes came out about what's going on with her. We know there's just generally a lot going on with Ons Jabeur at the moment, don't we? She's been very candid in her documentary about wanting to have a child and kind of putting pressure on herself to achieve certain tennis results and fulfill ambitions before she sort of permits herself to go and have that child. She has talked about the constant weight on her mind and in her life, the conflict in Gaza is at the moment. And that, of course, is very understandable and something we must bear in mind. But she's also managing an ongoing knee injury. And it sounds like that was sort of the most pressing thing on her mind during this match. She said, of course, first of all, congratulations to Beatrice. She played a great game. I wasn't feeling 100%. Unfortunately, my knee still bothers me a bit. These quotes are from The National. Today wasn't to be my day. I was trying to fight and get through this match. We go way back with the knee. Some tournaments it's good, some tournaments it's bad. I've been feeling it for the past week, but today was the worst day. Usually during practice I try to manage, but during matches it's a bit tougher. And then she was asked about which of the upcoming events, including of course Doha and Dubai, over the next couple of weeks she'll be playing. And she said, well, all of them, if my knee holds up, which really doesn't sound good to me. David, what do you think?
No, and the strange thing is watching her has it's been the same in Australia. She'll play one match where everything looks like it's flowing and it's just so enjoyable to watch. I mean, she hit well over 30 winners against Raducanu in a brilliant match. Both players, just for the first nine games of that match, were just striking winner after winner. And it was, and she was showing off, frankly, with her drop shots and all the rest of it. And if you remember, I said the same about a win early on in the Australian Open, and then she played Mira Andreeva and she was absolutely terrible. And frankly, she was not competitive. This maybe was more to do with the injury that she got beaten pretty severely by Adajmayr. But it is, that doesn't feel like there's this settled feel around her at all at the moment in terms of the what she's trying to do, what she's achieving when she's out there. You don't know what you're going to get from her. I don't think she knows what she's going to be able to get from her racket or her mind or her body. And if the knee is... that sounds like more of a problem than I realised that she's been having. And I feel for her, really, because she seems a bit lost just at the moment.
I shudder a bit at the sound of anybody managing an injury like that. It just sounds, like denial. It sounds like it is inevitable that you're going to have to take some time off. You're just trying to kind of keep the wolves at bay for as long as possible. And it just, I don't know, fills me with a bit of a sense of impending doom, I suppose. And I totally understand the denial. We talk a lot about the hamster wheel of this sport and the pressures to remain on it. I really don't like the sound of that for Jabeur, but we wish her well, absolutely. You mentioned Pliskova, David. She won the Transylvania Open. She beat Anna Bogdan 6-4, 6-3 in the final, just when you've sort of put Pliskova out of your mind and thought, I don't need to worry about what to do with her in predictions. Here she is popping her head above the parapet again and saying, I'm still here. You do still need to worry about me in your predictions. I mean, I know, look, it wasn't the field in Cluj that it was in Abu Dhabi, say, but she played some darn good tennis from what I saw, Matt.
She really did. Didn't drop a set the entire tournament. And look, maybe a really sensible move, actually. You know, there's a lot of players we're talking about in terms of trying to get back to where they were in the sport and make some comebacks. And, you know, she was out there playing a 250 unseeded Pliskova. You know, I mean, given her ranking, that sort of is the sort of level that she needed to be playing. But it was just a bit odd to see, you know, unseeded Karolina Pliskova in a tournament where Arantxa Rus is the top seed. And yet, you know, she's come through it and played so well. And, you know, it's her first title since before the COVID lockdowns. I mean, that was mad to me when I realized that, because she had that, you know, good run at Wimbledon and Montreal during sort of COVID times, but I hadn't realized that she hadn't won a title in so long. And, you know, this is someone who used to win a lot of titles. I think she's up to 17 now. You know, this is the sort of thing she used to do, sort of just come out of nowhere and win a title. I must say, as brilliant as Pliskova was, I obviously have a soft spot for formerly on the backhand list, Anna Bogdan. And she to me was the star of this week, wearing this incredibly sort of fire leopard print top.
I've already Googled where I can get that. Loved it so much.
Hitting the most stunning backhands, coming through a 3-hour epic on home soil and getting to the final. It was sort of just great WTA-ing. It was everything we love about that tour from Anna Bogdan this week. I had a great time watching her. And yeah, you're right though, Pliskova sort of being able to win tournaments again. Suddenly it's like, oh, what do we do with Pliskova again? Because like that top level, that big serve, those big flat ground strokes will be a threat to kind of whoever she plays. And even before this week, she pushed Rybakina at the Australian Open. She played that great match with Osaka in Brisbane. Like, there were little signs, I suppose, but she's put it together really consistently. And yeah, it'd be interesting to see if she can carry it on in any more meaningful way.
Yeah, and I do, that point you make about what a smart decision it was for Pliskova to play that event rather than going to Abu Dhabi. I do just wonder, you know, whether some of these players on the comeback trail could do with looking at events like the Transylvania Open and other similar sized events where, you know, all due respect to the draws, you're more likely to just get a couple of wins under your belt and get on a roll and get that winning feeling again and get the muscle memory of all the things that you can't replicate in practice. You know, Osaka, I thought, played well for periods against Danielle Collins, but the sharpness in the big moments just wasn't there. And I absolutely understand the pull of the bigger events. When you've won Grand Slam titles, you know, you're craving especially when you've had some time away from it, I'm sure you're craving the big stage and the big crowds and the big moments. And absolutely, I totally understand all of that. But I think it could be short-term pain for long-term gain. And Raducanu as well, watching her at the moment, she's actually fighting incredibly well against Angelina Kalinina. In Soon to Be Out of Tennis News, when we started this recording, she was 6-love, 1-love, love 40 down. She's not anymore. So well done. But I still think, I don't know, who am I to tell these great champions what they need to be doing? But I do think that was a very smart decision from Pliskova that I wonder if some of those players might look at.
Yeah, because I think Osaka now is playing 4 straight 1,000 events, isn't she? She's scheduled to play the Tour in the Middle East and then Indian Wells and Miami, which on the one hand, she might end up getting better draws because the top seeds at those events will have buys. But the depth of the field is such that you can still draw Caroline Garcia in the first round, as she has done this week, like she did at the Australian Open as well. Like, it just feels like she needs to get her teeth into a tournament in the way that Pliskova did in Cluj, and as you said, get some of that winning feeling back, I suppose. But, you know, it's possible that she will be able to do it at one of these 1,000 events.
Yeah, there's just too many good players, aren't there? I mean, what's a good draw anymore, especially at a 1,000 event?
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right.
Right, moving on to the many, many men's events that have been happening this week in Marseille. Who needs Jannik Sinner, Marseille, is what I would say to you. Because he had a tremendous amount of French success. He had a Frenchman in the final against good old Grigor Dimitrov. He had a Frenchman winning the title, 6-4, 6-3 for Hugo Humbert over a slightly out of gas Grigor Dimitrov, having come through his semi-final against Karen Khachanov quite late the night before. But Hugo Humbert, is he... Am I right that he's 5-5 in finals now?
Mm. Yeah, I did not know that until this final. That had passed me by. And that is a heck of a result, which is simultaneously impressive and also makes me wonder, why on earth is he not doing better generally? Why has he got a ranking for the first time inside the world's top 20? And everybody talks about what an incredible talent he is. I don't really understand why he has these long periods where you just don't think about him at all because he's not really doing anything, because he's clearly capable.
But by everyone, David, you mean my brother on our WhatsApp group, who's always talking about Ugo and Bear.
Yeah, he does. I mean, look, he absolutely pulls for him and loves him and rates him. But he's not the only one, because if you go, especially if you talk to people in France, they really rate the guy. And the feeling is that he should be doing more with that talent. And listen, let's go full stereotype. There's a lot of French players over the years that people have said that about. Here is a left-hander who seems to have just the most lovely ball strike. I mean, I think his serve can be attacked and all those sort of things. But just as a ball striker, he's really capable. And what is he, 25 now? Maybe some people are late developers and come into their own a bit later on. But I am surprised that somebody who's got a record like that in finals, which that seems quite unusual to me, to be that able when the nerves should be at their highest in a final in Marseille, and he just plays lovely, reliable tennis.
And it also extends to his record on the Challenger Tour. You know, when he was playing that tour more regularly than the ATP Tour, he won 8 of his 9 finals there as well. Like he's a man for the big tight moments, and like this felt like a bigger tournament than it is. I think with a Frenchman in the final in Marseille, like they really show up to their events, the French crowd. It is really incredible every time, and there was this sort of cauldron of an atmosphere in there, and he didn't, you know, he wasn't fazed by that at all. He really delivered, and there was a lovely moment of everyone spontaneously bursting into the Marseillaise afterwards. It was giving you all the feels, and he was brilliant this week. After a bad opening set against Hugo Gaston, he then took everyone else kind of to the cleaners. He'd never beaten Hurkacz before, beat him, and he'd never beaten Dimitrov before. And okay, Dimitrov was, I think, pretty knackered after that epic semi-final against Hachanov, but he beat him easily. And you mentioned his serve, David, and I've always thought that serve was perhaps a little bit of a weakness, but he was sort of unbreakable with it this week. You know, that lefty serve, he was swinging it into Dimitrov's backhand, he was hitting a lot of aces as well, and it's just generally it looked like that part of his game had got a lot better. And he was asked afterwards in the interview, sort of, what's changed this year? Because you seem to be playing better than ever. And he mentioned his serve, that he thinks that's got stronger. And he mentioned solid from the baseline and strong mentally as well. And, you know, these were all the things that he was doing. And I think there's always been a lot of excitement and maybe high expectations of him because he's got good records against all the top players. He's beaten Medvedev a lot. He's beaten Rublev, Tsitsipas, Zverev. He's got wins over all these players. It's just being able to do it consistently has sort of not been something that he's quite found yet. And if he's starting to get the consistency to go with his top level, then he's an exciting prospect as well, because he's a bit different. He's skillful. He's got quite compact ground strokes. He's obviously left-handed, takes the ball early, hits it flat. All stuff that I think suits indoor conditions, we should probably say. But like, there's a real player in there, and if he can push towards the top 10, I think that would be a fun storyline this season.
Also suits grass really well. Mm. He is a nifty grass court player, and there aren't many of those around. I think this could. I share your feeling, David. Of, well, if he's so good, where's he been? But I do think this could be it. Career high ranking. I agree with Matt. I've always just sort of lazily gone, oh, well, the serve is the reason that he's not higher than he is. But it's indoors, particularly on the serve. You have to take indoors with a slight pinch of salt, or at least an asterisk. But that serve looks beefed up to me. And I wonder if he's got Jeremy Chardy working with him, hasn't he? I think he's still got Thierry Essien, hasn't he, who's been working with for a while. But Jeremy Chardy, since retiring at the end of last year, has joined the team and looked not necessarily known for his own huge serve, but it doesn't always work like that, does it? It's obviously a different perspective, whatever it is working. I'm making a big Danielle Collins and Ugo Humbert prediction. Big but vague. There you go. Wasn't expecting to do that on this podcast, but there it is. Also in men's tennis this week. Oh, actually, should we mention the doubles in Marseille? Matt's put it in the agenda, so Matt would definitely like to mention the doubles in Marseille. What happened, Matt?
Well, the best player in the world might actually be one of the best doubles players in the world. Fresh from their run at the Australian Open, Zhang Zhizhen and Thomas Mahach won the title. I love that they've carried on playing. I think that's really great. I think there might come a time where they probably might need to drop the doubles if they have massive singles ambitions. But right now, I think they're both at career high singles rankings, and they're winning a lot of doubles matches together. Like, things are good in their world, and I'm here for it. They make a really fun pairing.
Yeah, I agree. It must just make life on tour that much more enjoyable for both of them. I mean, Zhang Zhizhen is one of those guys that you just sort of want to be in his orbit. He's got his aura is good vibes, and obviously Thomas Mahach is the best player in the world, so. What a team. Moving on to Dallas, an ATP 250 event there, won by Tommy Paul. Great final, 7-6, 5-7, 6-3 over Marcus Giron, the bare-armed Marcus Giron. David, I watched some highlights of this final. I kept on looking up and thinking it was sort of 2004-era Andy Roddick with the blue and white kit and the trucker style baseball cap. It was so much like the, I think it was Reebok that Andy Roddick was playing with at the time.
That's right. Yeah, visually I know where you're coming from there, and actually this felt like a sort of blue collar type of event, really, and it had a really good turnout of people. I mean, it was a bit of an aircraft hangar type of arena. You know, it's not visually the most attractive looking place in the world when you look at it, looking around this stadium. But they make do, and they make a good vibe, I think, in there this tournament. And I mean, it really does feel like the American closed tournament in a way, because all the players seem to be American. but they make the most of it. And Andy Roddick used to play a hell of a lot of those events in the mid-2000s and just clean up, you know. And, I mean, Tommy Paul gave Ben Shelton a pretty big hiding in the semifinals, scoreline-wise.
Did that worry you, David, from a Shelton perspective?
I mean, I didn't see all of it to be able to judge properly. I think Tommy Paul is a really good player who, as I've talked about before, is unremarkable to look at. As when I watch him play, my eye is not drawn to him. Yet when he plays his best stuff, he's bloody difficult to beat. I'd have to go back and watch it to get a view of Shelton. But I mean, I think it's an impressive run from Paul. He's kind of done what he's supposed to do. He's supposed to win this tournament in many ways, or at least get to the final. Garone, brilliant performance from him. I think he beat Francis Tiafoe along the way, and yeah, he's having some good results this year. Paul's had a bit of a blip, hasn't he? Because he came into that Australian Open and he has lost a couple of matches to Shelton of late. So it's a good one for him.
Yeah, I watched a lot of Dallas this week. It seemed to be on at a good time for me. And Shelton did have some tape on his abs through most of the week. He actually ripped it off in the match against Paul and said that it was no longer bothering him. But it never felt like the Shelton show. Like he never quite had it. His serve was awesome in the first two matches. He didn't get broken. But he really had to fight and come through impressively against Jordan Thompson. He didn't have anywhere near his best stuff, but it was a good gutsy win. But then that grit and resilience was just missing against Tommy Paul, and he made a lot of sort of unforced errors that, you know, he hadn't made the day before. I felt like there was just maybe a lot going on for him. He just didn't have that many matches in him that week, perhaps. Tommy Paul, I was impressed because Giron hit this incredible purple patch at the end of that second set in the final and was just winners everywhere. And it reminded me of the purple patch that Kecmanovic hit against Paul at the Australian Open to take it to a decider. And then Paul didn't show up in the final set of that match at the Australian Open at all. He was sort of borderline disgraceful, really, you know, just barely won points. And I had that in my mind. That was the last time I'd seen Paul in a deciding set, you know, and suddenly here he is in a final. Can he bring it? And he just got off to such a good start in that final set. And his tennis all week was excellent. Only his second ever title. And you feel like with his game, given the fact he's been to Australian Open semi-final, he needs to start sort of winning more titles, I suppose. And this is a very, very good start. You mentioned Giron beating Tiafoe. Sort of, we talked earlier about how the vibes are kind of tough with Ons Jabeur at the moment. It's very different reasons, I think. But Francis Tiafoe, my goodness, like, it is a real slump that he's in. I think he's only won two matches in a row once since the US Open, and that was largely as a result of Dan Evans getting injured against him. Like, it has been bad. Like, his form is bad. He looks like he's really struggling on court. And Giron absolutely, you know, was by far and away the better player in that match. And yeah, tough times for Tiafoe right now.
Yeah. And Tommy Paul, I think, could do with having a big result at one of Indian Wells or Miami, I think, couldn't he? Certainly carrying through this form that we saw this week into a bigger event, because he's got bigger ambitions. Finally, on the ATP Tour this week, we had a 250 event in Cordoba, Argentina, on clay. And we had two qualifiers in the final. David got very excited about this on Twitter, so I'm going to come to you about it, David. Luciano Darderi, who quite honestly I hadn't heard of before this week, beat Facundo Bagnis 6-1, 6-4 in the final. Why were you so excited, David?
Well, it was the emotion being shown. I mean, it is rare to get two qualifiers in a final like this. And Darderi, he'd never been inside the world's top 100 before this week. This tournament gets him into 76 in the world. And if you saw his semi-final, you would understand. You wouldn't need to be told those things, because he wins his match, and he was absolutely brilliant against Sebastian Baez. I wasn't best pleased about it, because I'd said Baez would win the tournament in the newsletter, so that's my points up in smoke. But my word, was he handily beaten by a guy who just knocked him off the court, who just came up with the shots when he's been pushed back out of the blue. And then when he wins, he is flat on his back like Rafael Nadal winning the French Open. He is looking up to the crowd, and his partner, his girlfriend or his wife, is in tears, and then he rushes over. It's the big full group hug with about six members of his team and family and friends. And then I decided to watch the Facundo Bagnis highlights as well. And he beats Federico Coria in a real tug of war match. And he's hanging over the net, crumpled in emotion as well. And it was just the most wonderful scene of an ATP 250, where you're just reminded that there's a lot of players out there where this is the peak of their career. Okay, maybe not Bagnis, it'll end up being, but it's a big deal for him. And it was just beautiful to watch the emotion on show. And sadly, in the final, I don't think Facundo Bagnis was fully fit. He was certainly very much second best. I mean, he lost the first five games in a row. Darderi was just on it. Congrats to him. Good on him. What a wonderful week. And he won seven matches, the equivalent of a Grand Slam, to win that title. And, you know, he's never going to forget that, is he?
I'd hope not. No. You've had a good life if you end up forgetting that in your sort of laundry list of good moments.
And it was so lovely watching the clay, Catherine, as well. That's the other thing. It just reminded me how much I love clay court tennis.
You've got a lot to come, David. So, can't wait. Yeah, I'm glad your appetite is whetted. I said that was the last men's event to cover from last week, but of course there was the Ultimate Tennis Showdown. Where was the Ultimate Tennis in Oslo? Of course, how could I forget Oslo? Won by Andre Rublev, but I mention this mostly because of a bizarre disqualification event involving Gael Monfils. I think, ironically, it might be time for Gael Monfils to stop playing exhibition type events because it's not going brilliantly, is it? Could you give us a potted summary of this hoo-ha, Matt?
Well, I mean, the whole thing was a bit of a hoo-ha because, like, as you said, it was in Oslo and I think Casper Ruud went out early. I think Team and Rune got the shits and had to pull out. And in amongst all that, you had Gael Monfils getting disqualified. Like, I just saw a notification on, I think it was Friday evening, from UTS, just a very, sort of matter of fact, following the disqualification of Lamonf. And I read it and I was like, oh, wait, what? Disqualified from UTS? How is that even possible?
I didn't think they had a code of conduct. Talking about a disqualification, you should probably just say Gael Monfils and not the not the nickname. But anyway,
with your relaxed code of conduct,
yeah. Like I thought that was the whole point of UTS. And anyway, there was then this sort of vacuum of information, and you know, everyone was speculating about what on earth it might be. There was then a statement from Monfils himself talking about this sort of incident that there'd been in the locker room where someone had got hurt, but you know, there was no malice. It sounded like it was, well, everyone was saying it was sort of an unintentional bit of an accident, but because someone got hurt, Monfils had to be disqualified. And then UTS finished their statement with, "See you next time, Monfils." It's just like, maybe that wouldn't be the best idea. Yeah, just weird. Like, why didn't they just say exactly what happened? That's what I think. There was just this speculation, this sort of Streisand effect, I suppose, that everyone sort of ended up probably coming up with something way more dramatic than what it actually was.
Yeah, it was weird. It was very weird. So who, Rune got the shits this week? Rune and Ruud? Who had the shits?
No, Rune and team.
Rune and team had the shits.
Yeah, Ruud lost. I don't know. He didn't win. I think he was meant to win in Oslo.
The segue I'm aiming for here is tough week for Holger Rune, having the shits in in Oslo, and also being jilted by Boris Becker. Sounds like it was Becker's decision. This is the second resignation from the Holger Rune coaching team in 2 weeks, I think, Severin Luthi last week, and now Boris Becker again says it's scheduling, unable to give the amount of time on the road as is needed by Holger Rune. I don't know any insider specifics to suggest that that's not true or that it's not the whole story, but I could certainly see a world in which that's not necessarily the whole story. It's got a very sort of Tory MP resigning to spend more time with their family energy about it, hasn't it? It just doesn't sound like great times in camp Rune to me. It's kind of regardless of what the full picture is.
No, I mean, and it's worth remembering that there are countries Boris Becker isn't allowed to travel to at the moment, with having been imprisoned last year.
But that would have been known, that was a known quantity at the time of their collaboration.
Absolutely. It just makes you question the thinking in the first place. But then there's so much about the Holger Rune setup that just feels a bit all over the place at the moment. You know, go through the last 6 months or so, you know, he stopped working with Patrick Mouratoglou and then immediately started working with him the very next week again, and then stopped working with him again, and comes into this year. You know, last week he got injured and had to withdraw from a tournament to retire from a match mid-match, and then but he straight off to Oslo to go and play in this thing, you know, and then he signs up with Severin Luthi, the longtime coach of Roger Federer, and with Boris Becker, has a team photo together in Monte Carlo. 6 weeks later, that entire team is dismantled. Certainly those two effective super coaches are in and then out within 6 weeks. He has just signed up, I saw, with IMG. So no doubt Max Eisenbutter will be maybe looking at things in a slightly different way. I certainly heard that they're planning to run his media commitments from now on, which I believe had been run by his mother before that. And he's straight off now to Rotterdam. He's playing there, second seed. Now, who am I to say what are the right choices for a tennis player to make in their development? But my mind goes back to Stefanos Tsitsipas, of all people, a year and a bit ago at the Australian Open, saying that he thinks that Rune is almost too obsessed with tennis and needs to just chill out a bit. And Tsitsipas is a guy I've always thought plays too often. And Rune is just playing all the time. And he's injured a lot of the time. During those matches, you know, he talked about managing injuries for Ange Dubert. I think there's a real danger that Rune either gives himself a real injury that is a problem for the future, or just keeps on doing this kind of tournament-to-tournament existence where you don't really get any kind of momentum and you're not building your career. I mean, you've got to think about the way Jannik Sinner in the last 6 months has turned things in his favour. Rune should have that level of talent. And I don't know, I sort of think that Eisenbud might be able to help just construct a bit more professionalism around him, you know, just with his vast experience. Who knows? There are alarm bells for me, Catherine, I have to say, around Rune, but just certainly recent months.
Yeah, I'm sad that I fear the Eisenbud, the IMG collaboration will lead to a slightly less entertaining Holger Rune Twitter account. because that's been an occasional gift over the past few months and years. Last bit of coaching news from last week, probably the biggest shock, well, definitely the biggest shock in a while, really. Jessica Pegula and David Witt have split. Pegula is also out of the whole Middle East swing with a neck injury. Last saw her play that incredibly limp defeat to Clara Burrell in the third round of the Australian Open. This doesn't sound great to me. David Witt gave a quote, didn't he, where he made it clear that this was a shock and a surprise to him. And look, it may very well end up being the right thing. We're not privy to what's, you know, going on in the background, but that's not the sort of quote you give out when things have ended well and because of nice, happy reasons. I don't think. And her greatest successes have come since she teamed up with David Witt in 2019, I think it was, wasn't it? So doesn't sound brilliant for Team Pegula just now.
No, and actually, I simultaneously am immensely surprised by it because they just seem such a good fit, a very solid partnership, continuity, and as you say, all the success they've had. And then at the same time, I think, well, what have I been questioning from Jessica Pegula for the last 2 years? It's, can she turn that consistency into major breakthroughs? Maybe she's just thinking, well, I haven't made that major breakthrough. So maybe I need to just roll the dice here and try something completely different and see if that will be the key. I don't know. I'm only speculating, but that's a possibility.
Yeah, I mean, David, I had exactly the same thought that, you know, maybe this is a sort of jolt, a sort of trying something different. I think it's just the sort of in amongst everything else that's happening with Jessica Pegula at the moment, it doesn't quite feel quite so positive, I suppose. I suppose the fact that he said he was surprised, as you said, suggests that there was maybe a slight breakdown in communication there. And just the fact that she hadn't been playing well, she'd had to pull out of events. There's just a lot going on right now for Jessica Pegula, I suppose. And she's been kind of immune to all that. She's just consistently played all the time and kept winning and been really, really consistent. And this is now a sort of slightly turbulent period, I suppose. So the fact that this coaching change comes within that turbulent period, I suppose, is what makes me think, ooh, I'm a little bit concerned by that, I suppose. But if it is a move to just say, look, you've taken me as far as you can take me. We've been brilliant together. I need to try something different. Then there could be, you know, there could be a positive side to it as well. I suppose we just have to see when she gets back on the tour in a month or so.
Yeah, we wish her well in all respects. In terms of this week, we have the WTA 1000 event just getting underway in Doha. Emma Raducanu has just lost to Angelina Kalinina, 6-love, 7-6. She had a set point in the second set tiebreak, but Kalinina turned that around. Pretty much everybody in Doha, except for Aryna Sabalenka and, of course, Jessica Pegula. Sabalenka, the big omission, wanting some more time after Australia, very understandably so. The ATP is in Rotterdam for a 500 event. This is the return of Jannik Sinner to the match court. He'll play his first match since the Australian Open, and he'll play Botik van der Zandschulp in a mirror of his first round at the Australian Open. We've also got Hercac Lehechka round one, Runa Sofiulin, Duminor Korda, Prismic. Remember him? Dino Prismic against David Goffin. I think it's safe to call that a clash of the generations. And Emil Ruusuvuori against Hugo Humbert. Oh, and Dimitrov against Sonego. Those are all first round matches in Rotterdam. The ATP is also in Buenos Aires for a 250 event. Alcaraz playing there. Also Cameron Norrie, Nicholas Jarry, Arthur Fils, Stan Wawrinka.
Hey.
And the ATP are also in Delray Beach for a 250, where it's, once again, lots of Americans and Adrian Mannarino, with an added sprinkle of Dan Evans. Very similar field to Dallas, except substitute a Tommy Paul for a Taylor Fritz, basically, and you're there. You've got yourself a Delray Beach.
Adrian Mannarino got to the semifinals in Dallas last week, playing 52 minutes of tennis. Like, there was a bye, a walkover, and a retirement, and he was in the semis.
He's weird in all the ways, isn't he?
And shout out to Blair in the on-court interview, who got him a bottle of tequila after one of his wins.
Very well done, Blair Henley. That's that gag is going to keep on giving, isn't it? We have a mascot for this episode, and it is Spotty, owned by Caleb. I cannot tell you how much I love this picture of Spotty. It's one of my all-time favourite mascot photos. It honestly looks like an album cover or a movie poster, or just I can't believe it's real. Spotty is a small 4 kilos, so that's about Billie Jean size, so can confirm that small, a mutt from the Humane Rescue Alliance in Washington, D.C. They're approximately 10 years old in February 2024, and it's 7 years since they adopted one another. Spotty was estimated to be 3 years old at the time of adoption, enjoys travelling, the outdoors, hiking and backpacking, hanging out at the tennis courts, being in bed, brackets, cuddling and napping, and being part of the DC queer and trans Asian community. Oh, I love Spotty so much. This photo is going on our Instagram, and just go and check it out, quite frankly. Yoda sort of energy, except prettier than Yoda, I would say. But with the sort of the wisdom and ears of Yoda, that's what I'm getting at with the Yoda thing.
I thought the same.
Yeah, okay, good. I'm I'm really into Spotty. This photo is amazing. So that's Spotty. Hello and thank you to Spotty and to Caleb. David also has his mascot, Francis. Matt has Hyder and Soma. And Billie Jean, of course, has Billie Jean King and Alana Kloss. And there's a name and a mascot missing from that list. And that is Darwin, of course. My mascot for this year, a previous mascot with varying degrees of success to both Matt and David, and I'm very sorry to report that Darwin is no longer with us, or rather no longer with me. I'm so sorry that that I didn't do him prouder, and I'm so sad for Carrie that she is going through the loss of a dog, because it's tremendously sad and upsetting. And we are going to pay a full tribute to Darwin in our newsletter this week. But in short, Darwin, thank you for being such a loyal supporter of the Tennis Podcast. I'm sorry I didn't do better for you. And thank you, Carrie, for bringing Darwin into our lives. And I'm so sorry for what you must be going through just now. It's desperately sad, and I am thinking of you a lot, and we will be paying tribute to Darwin in this week's newsletter. Which leaves me just to say, of course, that we have our top folks and executive producers, Greg, Chris, Jamie and Jeff, and no shout-outs this week, folks, except one big shout-out and thank you to Darwin and to Carrie. David, you gave Darwin some glory, at least.
I loved having Darwin as my mascot as well. I really did. And yeah, I'm thinking of you as well, Carrie.
Yeah, absolutely. Thinking of you, Carrie. That is your lot for this week's Tennis Podcast. We'll, be, of course, be back with another in a week's time with plenty to talk about, because tennis is the ultimate gift that keeps on giving. Thank you for listening. We'll speak to you then.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market. Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.